Crazy or not, asked me to find it. We'll wear gloves. I do not want to touch anything that's been in contact with Carr's bodily fluids anyway. A little shudder went through her body, and she put down the rest of the uneaten empanada, having lost her appetite. Do you really think a gunman's after me? If Libby and I were both on the hit list, I can't believe Pros wouldn't have sent more than one guy to the hospital. And if you're worried about my paparazzi and fans, I'll wear dark glasses and plain clothes. Nothing flashy. I won't use my own car. I'll have Peter drive me. You'll do that, won't you, Peter?
Sure. We can work something out.
Brian was nodding as Peter spoke, as though he had something to say about it.
Oh, I have to go along. I need to see your mother, too.
Bernadette spoke in a solemn way, but with a spark in her eyes that gave her away. She was eager to find out what was in that suitcase.
No offense, Peter and Brian, but I'd rather drive, unless you all will let me ride shotgun.
Brian sat up straight.
That's my job, Brian said. I'm the one who needs to be in that seat, just in case something happens and Peter needs professional help.
You are not qualified to provide that kind of professional help, Brian.
No guns, Peter admonished.
That goes for you too, Bernadette.
No guns, Jessica added.
She wasn't sure what was more terrifying, the thought of Bernadette or Brian armed with live ammunition. That reminded her she still had her dad's gun in her purse.
Here's an idea. You drive, but use one of our agency cars instead of the Escalade. The vehicle I have in mind protects passengers from bullets. Brian and I will follow you. When we get to the condo, I'll make sure the underground parking area is secure before you get out of the car. That ought to make you feel better, right, Frank?
What if you find something that needs to be taken into evidence?
Then what?
Gloves won't prevent a smart lawyer from arguing that the evidence was tampered with somehow before it got to the police.
Okay, so you come along, Frank. Get Uncle Don to put you into the proper chain of custody. You're all Riverside County law enforcement. Better yet, bring him along, too. We'll do everything by the book. I promise.
Field trip, field trip, Tommy chanted.
I say we all go. Why don't we check out Carr's office in condo, too?
He continued, his eyes brightening at the thought of an adventure.
Now you want to trample those places, too, by taking the entire cat pack through them?
Frank was in full-blown cop paranoia mode.
The cat what?
Betsy asked, with a puzzled expression on her face. In response, several members of the cat pack, excluding Kim, who had yet to say a word, spoke at once.
Wait a second, please. This is getting more confusing, not less. You need to appoint an official spokesperson and clue me in.
Heads swiveled in unison, like cats, all following the same dangling string toward Jessica.
That would be me.
She spent the next few minutes filling Betsy in on their loosely constructed association. Betsy got it right away. She was aware of the Valley's legendary status as a playground for the much more sophisticated Rat Pack, headed up by that other Frank.
In response to your question, Frank, no, I don't think we should all go traipsing through Carr's home and office. But Tommy has a good idea. Why don't we divide up? You and I can take a team to Libby's condo and Carr. The rest can go to Carr's office in Beverly Hills and to his house in Pacific Palisades.
Betsy had a great idea that we might learn something about Carr's silent partner by going through Carr's Rolodex and his client referral system.
What does that mean for the whole chain of custody thing?
Peter asked.
Frank can't be everywhere.
Uncle Don can go with us, and he can be on our team, Tommy said with excitement.
I doubt he'll agree to any of this. You know what a stickler he is. Besides, he's not even in the homicide division. He won't have anything to do with this looky-loo business.
Frank was stuck in stubborn cop mode.
It couldn't hurt to ask, could it?
That was Kim, breaking her silence to weigh in on the idea.
Field trip, field trip, sleep over, Tommy chanted again, stopping when several pairs of eyes focused on him.
What? We'll be in Beverly Hills. Shishi hotels, shopping, restaurants, spas?
Did I say shopping?
You'll get me into so much trouble with Father Martin. He's trying to get me to do more for my favorite charities instead of shopping.
Are you saying I'm not a favorite charity?
Tommy's bottom lip poked out like a spoiled child.
I can't afford lunch at Spago, or a night at the Ritz-Carlton, or a bottle of bubbly and a romantic couple's massage.
Jerry blushed as Tommy looked at him lasciviously. Frank choked.
The Ritz-Carlton? Are you kidding?
Oh, okay, Frank. Are you a Four Seasons fan? How about the Beverly Wilshire Hotel? We can relive the best moments from Pretty Woman. I loved that movie. Heck, you can almost spit on Rodeo Drive from the window of your hotel room. It's so close. We won't even have to drive to shop till we drop.
I don't think it's a good idea for anybody to spit on Rodeo Drive, Brian said.
I do like that movie. Julia Roberts is still banging. For an older babe.
The Beverly Wilshire is obscenely expensive, too. You don't have to shell out that kind of cash for me. Besides, if we find something, Dad and I will want to drive back to Riverside County and put it into evidence as soon as we can.
At that moment, Jessica realized the decision had been made. Even Frank was in.
Yes, we don't have to stay there, but it would be fun. That light in Jessica's eyes tells me she's ready to wave that black Amex card around. Our angel heiress loves to play fairy godmother.
Laura sighed, smiling ruefully at Jessica.
It is a great hotel, Kim said, deadpan. My old boss did a film shoot there that put a different spin on the Pretty Woman thing.
Ooh, tell us, Tommy said, knowing about the adult-themed films Kim's former boss had made.
No, please don't. I'd prefer not to know, Jerry insisted. I'll agree to let Jessica pay for an overnight, but I don't want to be flashing on anything that little creep might have done.
Jessica's head was spinning with all the chatter. Laura was right that she needed to get to work wielding that black Amex card. But what to do first? Call Don Fontana, make hotel reservations for Saturday night, figure out how early they should leave in the morning, or should they drive in tonight? How could she explain this to Father Martin?
Bernadette came to the rescue.
We need to eat before the food gets cold. Dig in, you guys.
Jessica, I don't think Father Martin will mind.
If you want to go to Malibu and Manhattan Beach in one day, you'll be exhausted. Staying overnight isn't a bad idea. We could stay at Hank's place in Brentwood, but I don't think he's ready to face the whole cat pack.
Do you?
She asked.
No, I don't think he'll ever be ready for that, Jessica replied.
Frank, will you call your dad and see if he'll agree to go with us? If he says yes, it's a deal, okay?
Frank pulled out his phone and hit a button.
Dad, have you got a minute?
Ask him if he'll agree to go to lunch with us at the Beverly Wilshire so we can all debrief, okay?
Frank nodded, understanding Jessica's request. Jessica did a quick count in her head regarding the number of rooms they would need. Not more than a minute later, Frank gave her a thumbs up. Uncle Don was in, and it was a go.
Betsy, do you want to join us?
Jessica glimpsed a little flash of something pass over Pete's face. Anticipation, maybe? Jessica noted.
I'd love to, but I'm doing an in-service training tomorrow.
On a Saturday? Peter blurted out.
Yes, and I don't dare let my staff down, or they'll be looking around for training on law of attraction therapy or some other nonsense to get continuing education credit. Not all the wackiness in my life comes from my clients. I'll take a rain check, though, and I'd love to hear all about it, if you'll call me later, Peter.
That big, goofy smile was back on his face as Betsy wrote her cell phone number on a business card and handed it to him. In the meantime, Tommy whipped out his phone. In another minute, he punched in a number and handed his phone to Jessica.
The Beverly Wilshire, he said, doing a little happy dance as she took the phone from him.
Jerry rolled his eyes at Tommy's audaciousness.
What?
Tommy asked as Jessica shushed him.
Yes, I'd like to reserve several rooms for tomorrow night.
With that, she was off and running. No need to dig out that black Amex card, because the information emblazoned on the card stood out in bold relief in her head. She had used that card so much that she'd committed the numbers to memory. In minutes, it was all arranged. A dinner reservation at Spago, too.
Betsy's words played over in Jessica's mind. Not all of the wackiness in my life comes from my clients.
So true. Libby wasn't her client, but Jessica couldn't let it go. What could be stashed away in that little blue case? Could it help them find Carr's silent partner?
Jessica glanced at Betsy, who was chatting with Peter like they were old friends. She thought of the conviction in Betsy's voice when she assured Jessica that Carr's associate was close. How close? And did he have a hired gun waiting to take another shot at Libby or her?
In over my head. Time to swim for it, she thought as she looked up. Frank stood there with a plate of food for her and a look that said it all. Come on in. The water's fine.
22. Condo search. On Saturday morning, Jessica awoke with anticipation, thinking about the day ahead. Peter would drop off their specially equipped, nondescript, late-model car. That car would be unfamiliar to anyone tailing them, whether from the media or on the payroll of the Red Devil. Peter and Brian would provide escort in another of the vehicles owned by his security company, choosing one they used for surveillance, rather than the black SUVs they preferred to use as escort vehicles. Once they were on the road, Jessica called Detective Hernandez and let him in on their plans for the day. She didn't go into all the details about their field trip and sleepover at the Beverly Wilshire because it was too early in the morning to tangle with him if she got him riled up. She had worried needlessly. He was almost effusive in his praise for the way Jessica had planned her latest foray into sleuthing. He was grateful for the help, given how short-handed they were in Cat City. As it also turned out, he was still a homicide detective, without evidence of a homicide. The body found in Cathedral Canyon was not Shannon Donnelly, but a homeless woman who was a longtime drug addict. They wouldn't know for sure what caused her death until they got a tox screen back from the lab in another week.
I'll owe you one after this. I'd warn you off, given that incident at the hospital, if Frank and Don hadn't been willing to go with you. They're both good cops, and should be able to keep you out of trouble.
Well, thanks for the vote of confidence, I think.
You'll keep me in the loop on anything you discover that might apply to Ms. Donnelly's disappearance. If you find that suitcase, you'll make sure it gets into the proper hands.
Yes, that is the whole point behind having police officers with us, even on their day off.
Nice of them to do that for you.
True, but they owe me one for the work I did to find Kelly's killer, and they're willing to take a chance on this being a wild goose chase to get more information about Carr and Libby. And if it's not a wild goose chase, there's the possibility that something might provide a link to whoever's behind that attempt on Libby's life.
I'm sure I don't have to tell you to be careful and do exactly as the Fontanas tell you.
This was getting old fast.
No problem. I'll talk to you later. The road trip to Manhattan Beach was uneventful. Sitting in that car for over 2 hours, even with the seat back about as far as it could go, wasn't comfortable. Jessica tried to keep apprehension from overtaking her, not just about what they might find at Libby's condo, but what awaited them later in Malibu. With GPS, none of them had trouble finding Libby's condo. When they arrived, Jessica spotted Frank's car parked at the curb near the entrance to the underground parking area. A quick call to the security team at the condo complex got them access to the area in no time. Once inside the garage, they checked Libby's car first. Jessica used the electronic key Libby's mother had given her to unlock the doors. Peter, who had already taken pictures of the scene as soon as they identified Libby's car, snapped photos of the car's interior. Donning a pair of latex gloves, Frank opened all four doors as Peter circled the car, snapping away. Jessica and Bernadette hung back, chomping at the bit to find that suitcase. But from where they stood, a few feet away, it was clear there was no suitcase in the car. Frank bagged the few items in Libby's car. He checked the glove compartment and found nothing there either, other than the items you'd expect to find, including a vehicle owner's manual, insurance card, registration, and a California road map. Jessica realized she'd been holding her breath as Frank searched all the pockets and compartments in the car, finding nothing in them.
Peter, I'll pop the trunk so you can photograph that too, okay? Jessica said as Frank finished his search of the car's interior.
Sure,
he said, moving to the back of the car.
Jessica hit a button on the electronic key fob and released the latch on the trunk. Frank stepped around to the back, too. He lifted the trunk lid, and Peter took a couple of photos. More disappointment gripped Jessica. There was a bag in the back, but no blue suitcase. Instead, they found a dark green duffel bag containing a pair of yoga socks, leggings, a t-shirt, a towel, and a lightweight, rolled-up mat that Frank unrolled and then re-rolled. As he looked through the items, Peter continued to document each item.
I'm not sure what we're looking for, since there's no blue suitcase in here.
Frank placed the items he'd removed back inside the duffel bag.
I'll put this in my evidence container in the back of my car anyway.
Frank stacked the bagged items from the car interior on top of the gym bag and picked them all up.
Oh my God, is that a rosary? Jessica asked.
Yes, it's broken, but I'm pretty sure all the pieces are there.
Bernadette's the expert on that front. Let's let her see it, okay?
Sure, as long as she doesn't remove it from the bag.
Do you want me to put on those snooper gloves first?
Bernadette asked.
No, I don't think that's necessary. Let Peter take a couple photos, though, before you touch it.
Frank took the bag containing the rosary and flattened it out for the photo. He flipped it over and had Peter take another shot. Bernadette peered at the broken string of beads for about a minute before speaking.
There are pieces missing. It's broken right near the section holding the crucifix. See how there are three brown beads, and then a silver bead, then the cross? There should be a silver bead first, then the three brown beads. The missing bead is the Glory B bead. There should also be a small medallion linking the sections together, but that's gone too.
They were leaning over Bernadette's shoulder, trying to see what she was talking about.
What's up, guys?
They all jumped about a foot off the ground. Brian, who had fallen asleep riding shotgun, had joined them. A surge of pain shot through Jessica.
Ark, Brian, don't go sneaking up on people like that, Bernadette chided him.
Why not? I was practicing being stealthy. Guess I'm getting good at it too, huh?
I'm an old lady. You could have given me a heart attack.
Oh, okay, sorry.
What are we doing? Brian asked. We're letting Bernadette examine a rosary we found in Libby's car, Jessica replied.
Wow, that's good, isn't it? Libby said you should find that, right?
True, but it's not clear yet what we can learn from a broken rosary. Frank, are you sure you collected all the pieces from the car?
I can check again, but I think so,
he said.
When did Libby tell you about a rosary? Why didn't I hear about that?
Jessica explained how the rosary issue had only come up the day before, when Libby had that episode in the ICU. Bernadette interrupted Jessica's conversation with Frank. She'd been peering at the broken rosary.
There's not just something missing, but something that shouldn't be in there.
Mira, Bernadette said as she pointed. They all leaned in close again.
See that smear on the shiny back of the crucifix? What does that look like to you?
It's hard to tell, but it could be blood and maybe a partial fingerprint,
Frank answered after another few moments.
I'll call this into Hernandez. Somebody needs to pick up this car and go over it thoroughly if this turns out to be blood. That's totally spooky. How did blood get on a crucifix?
Brian asked.
Whose blood is it? Not the big kahunas, right? Can you pick up any vibes from holding it using your powers?
Ay, Dios mío, Brian. If by big kahuna you mean Jesus, the answer is no. Stop with all the questions and the spooky stuff.
Bernadette crossed herself like she was trying to ward off something evil.
The lab will have to tell us if it's blood and whose it is. I don't suppose Libby or her mother said anything about who owned that rosary,
Frank asked. No, Libby's mom didn't know why she was talking about a rosary. She doesn't think Libby's been a practicing Catholic in a long time. Libby was so insistent on the need to find it. Maybe it belonged to Shannon Donnelly and that blood is hers. Not a pleasant thought. I can't come up with a good scenario to explain a broken rosary with a bloody crucifix. Can you?
Let's not jump to conclusions, but it's probably not a good thing. Maybe the lab can get something from that fingerprint.
Frank sighed as he picked up the items. I guess we've done all we can here. It's time to go upstairs and see if that suitcase is in the condo, Jessica said, getting an anxious little tickle of doom as they stood in the low light of the parking garage. Give me a minute to get these items in the evidence container in my trunk. Jessica, will you lock up the car as soon as I get it all closed up again?
Sure. She used the key fob to lock the car and set the alarm, still pondering the significance of that rosary. What was it doing in Libby's car? She wondered. The police already had DNA samples from both Libby and Shannon, so it would be straightforward to find out if the blood belonged to one of them. Jessica felt a wave of foreboding about the Donnellys' missing daughter.
Okay, where's that key to the condo? Frank asked.
Jessica handed him the key and let him lead the way to the elevator. Top floor, she said before he could ask. Condo number 48. I suppose you should have all the keys, Jessica added, handing him the key to the car and the small key to Libby's mailbox.
Thanks. We should collect her mail and haul that back to the sheriff's department, just in case there's something in it that Dad's guys or Hernandez can use.
When they entered the condo after a silent ride in the elevator, Jessica's dark mood lifted. High ceilings and an open floor plan gave the space a bright and airy feeling. The stylishly contemporary decor was in keeping with the architecture of the condo complex. Sleek marble flooring and other pricey finishes were everywhere. Upscale kitchen appliances looked brand new. Jessica guessed the two wealthy young women who lived in the place didn't cook for themselves. There was nothing in the fridge except yogurt and a variety of supplements. Built along a busy street, the complex didn't sit on the beach, but across the road from it. A corner unit, the views from a bank of windows and sliding doors were spectacular. A spacious deck provided plenty of room for entertaining or taking in the view.
Whoa, this is awesome, Brian exclaimed. I could totally live here. That patio was big enough to stash my surfboard and my bicycle. I bet it is. Libby had to be upset about losing a place like this, Peter said. Didn't her parents buy it for her? Yes, Frank, but the taxes and homeowner's fees must be several thousand a month. Even with Shannon Donnelly sharing the expenses, Libby might have been in trouble when that trust ended since she had no job. Well, that gives her a motive for trying to get money out of her parents, that's for sure. Money from her uncle would have come in handy, too.
That's for sure. I remember her parents talking with her about selling it and helping her downsize to something more affordable. That was right before Libby made those awful allegations. Mind you, they weren't talking about cutting her off when the trust ended. They were trying to come up with something that would work for her longer term, since she'd made little headway on education and a career during her probation.
It would be hard to give up this lifestyle and settle for something less. Even scaling down might mean working for a living. Not something she looked forward to, I imagine, Peter commented.
You wouldn't think that would turn her into a raging monster toward her parents, but what do I know? Jessica let out an exasperated sigh.
Disturbed and unhappy women will resort to desperate measures, Jessica. Look at what happened to Kelly.
Frank had a sad look on his face. Jessica reached up and touched his face. I get it, Jessica said. Look at my own mother, she thought, as she removed her hand. A wave of anxiety hit as she considered the desperate and unhappy woman waiting for her in another spot along the gorgeous SoCal coastline. She glanced at Bernadette, who must have guessed what she was thinking.
Sometimes they get help when they're desperate, Bernadette said in a reassuring way.
Good point. In this case, Libby and Shannon were trying to do that when they met up with Dr. Demento. That makes me furious.
Well, she wasn't completely sucked in by the guy if she kept items to blackmail him. Let's see if we can find that suitcase and throw some light on what he did.
They spent the next hour going through Libby's condo. No blue suitcase could be found anywhere in the condo. Jessica was sore, although she had been on light duty, mostly watching as the others snooped. They had divided up, searching each room. Peter and Brian on one team, with Frank and Bernadette on the other. Peter had even given Brian a boost so he could check out the attic. Nothing.
Jessica was about to call it quits when something Brian had said got her to thinking. Brian, where do you keep your surfboard? You don't have a patio, not like this one anyway.
Even if I did, I'm on the first floor so someone could walk off with it. My apartment is small or I'd keep it inside.
Okay, so where? She didn't wait for him to answer before getting up and heading to the kitchen. She'd seen a small key taped in place inside one of the drawers.
I have a storage space at the complex that's...
Before he could finish, she interrupted him as she pulled the key free from the tape. Peter, can you call the security guys you spoke to when we first arrived and ask if there's a storage area available to condo owners?
I'm on it,
he said, dialing as he spoke.
They say yes. It's down on the same level as the parking garage. You need a key, and each homeowner has an assigned compartment. The one associated with this unit is...
D8, Jessica called out, holding up the key as she headed for the door.
Bingo,
Bernadette hollered. Jessica took a quick look around, making sure they were leaving Libby's lovely home the way they'd found it. Not that it was likely to be her home again, given the latest news from the ICU. Depending on what they learned about Shannon Donnelly's fate, even if Libby made it out of the ICU functional enough to live on her own, she might be moving to new accommodations, courtesy of the criminal justice system. Energized by a surge of hope, they headed back down to the lower level. Using the directions given to Peter, they found the storage area. Frank insisted that they go back into evidence collection mode, having Peter snap photos of the area as he donned a pair of gloves. Almost as soon as the door opened, they spotted a small blue suitcase, part of a matched set, stashed away in the walk-in storage area. Peter snapped away, and then Frank picked up the suitcase and set it on top of the largest piece of luggage in the set. As soon as he opened it, they all gasped.
Ew,
Jessica said. 23. A familiar face. Even surrounded by luxury and beauty, lunch was less pleasant than it might have been without having viewed the contents of that little blue bag. It was illuminating, however. Their group sat poolside with gorgeous blue skies overhead, tall palms swaying, and cheery sounds of resort-goers. The iconic hotel had a lot of nostalgia for Jessica, not because of the Julia Roberts movie, but because she had been there many times with her mother. After Alexis divorced Hank, she and Jessica stayed at the hotel for spa treatments, shopping, and gadding about town. Often, one or two of Alexis's cronies joined them for part of the day, and Jessica brought friends, too. Laura was with her today, but no Kelly. No Mom. All that history intersected, at oddly disorienting angles, with the latest calamity, courtesy of another troubled young woman hurtling towards self-annihilation. Jessica was awash in a sea of angst and dread, and put off food after getting a look at the contents of that suitcase. It did nothing to dampen Brian's appetite, so they ordered drinks and appetizers. Jessica could have used a stiff shot of whiskey or something, but couldn't because of the meds she was taking. A blast from the past hit Jessica broadside as she remembered her mother and one or more of her friends putting away cocktails with lunch. Even as an adult, I'd be under the table if I tried to keep up with them, she thought, remembering all those diamond rings flashing as they clinked glasses. The contents of the little blue bag were what Jessica had expected, except worse. She was prepared to find a dress, like the one Monica Lewinsky had kept as a souvenir of her tryst with Clinton, but what they found was more like preparations for a mini-exhibit at a freak show. The disturbed young woman had packaged and preserved a variety of items, including underwear, his and hers, sealed in baggies labeled with dates, times, and locations. A small shock of white hair and nail clippings were in bags with stickers reading Dr. Dick, along with the graphic details of how she had obtained them. Swabs of who knows what were sealed and marked. Jessica didn't ask Frank for details as he went through the contents of Libby's small suitcase, setting out each grotesque item for Peter to photograph. There were also several small jars containing what Jessica and Frank surmised to be a preservative. The whiff she got when they first opened that case conjured up a rush of old images from Biology 101 labs. Formaldehyde. What was floating in the containers required speculation that Jessica had no desire to make. She would leave that to the crime lab, where Frank planned to take all the items as soon as their debriefing was over. I've already called Detective Hernandez and reported what we found in the car, condo, and the storage unit. He's getting a warrant to have Libby's car impounded, presuming the spot on the rosary is blood. He's laying odds it's more likely to be Shannon Donnelly's blood than Libby's, but we'll have to wait for the lab results. He glanced at Jessica, who was still feeling a little green around the gills as she sipped Diet Coke to settle her stomach. The sips fell into a pit she recognized from previous visits to the land of dirtbags and the misguided women who loved them. She included herself as one of them, having fallen for a dirtbag of her very own. She tried not to block Frank out as he ran through the list of oddities found in Libby's little bag of horrors to inform the team that had gone to Dr. Carr's home and office instead of the condo.
That girl has watched way too many episodes of CSI, Kim said.
Well, what has Hernandez on the move are several labeled Shannon Donnelly. Some suspicious-looking items for sure. Bloody tissue, several blonde hairs, and a bag containing a small amount of sand and gravel, each marked not only with Shannon's name, but also with the phrase, Dr. Dick's Mercedes. The license plate number was included, and items were dated the day after Shannon disappeared. Holy cow! Shannon must have met up with Carr after that fight in the parking lot. And if Libby went through his car on the date she claims, she must have seen Carr, too.
Did she tell the police?
Tommy asked. Not a word. Mind you, she lawyered up quick once they took her in and questioned her about that last evening she spent with Shannon. I doubt Hernandez even asked Libby about Carr, since her shrink wasn't in the picture that early in the investigation. It was another day or two before they found out both women had called him the night Shannon disappeared. Carr acknowledged he received the calls, but didn't tell the police he saw either woman. What do you want to bet he picked Shannon up from the parking lot that night? Who knows what happened next?
He is not going to tell us. Libby may never be able to do that either,
Laura responded. Why didn't Libby tell me that Carr picked up Shannon if she'd figured that out? I don't get it.
Their brains don't work like ours. Call it mental illness or bad judgment if you like, but in my experience, folks who get mixed up with the Dr. Carrs of the world are concerned more about the wrong he's done to them than to others. Concern about what happened to her friend is almost an afterthought. At least Libby expressed some remorse about Shannon Donnelly's fate, although we don't know what that is yet.
Frank shook his head. Sadness or weariness slowed his movements. Well, at one point, Libby stated flat out that Shannon Donnelly is dead. I presume she knows more than she was willing to reveal during her meltdown at the top of the tram. Still, as angry as she was with Dr. Dick, you'd expect she'd be delighted to pin murder on him if she had the evidence. Why simply rat him out for sexual indiscretion?
Unless, no matter what she claims with the tags on those baggies, what she's doing is cleaning up after herself. All we have is her word for it, that the items came from Carr's auto. The license plate number is no real proof. What if it's an effort to frame Carr?
That would have required more organization than Libby was capable of, don't you think? Laura asked. I mean, she was drunk when Shannon went missing. I could imagine Libby lashing out and killing Shannon in that condition. But frame her shrink?
I doubt it. Hey, you know what they say, don't you? Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. If she had it in for the dude, that could have helped her focus long enough to set him up.
They all stopped talking and stared at Brian. He was trying to fish the maraschino cherry out of the bottom of his glass. As they watched, he put down the straw he'd been using and upended the glass. He got his wish as the maraschino cherry fell, along with a face full of ice.
Brian has a point, no matter how big a fool he's making of himself,
Bernadette offered. Brian, who was cleaning himself off, stopped putting errant ice cubes back into his glass and spoke.
Give a guy a break, will you? I'm starving. If they'd brought me my nachos already, I wouldn't have had to do that.
Bernadette ignored him as she picked up where she'd left off. Healing Shannon and making it look like her shrink did it would be a way to get back at them both. That doesn't mean she's any good at it. Anger and revenge can only get you so far.
could be just far enough to get you into more trouble. Revenge is right up there with sex and money as a motive for murder. Maybe you're all right. This could be more about cleaning up after herself, by pinning it on Carr as an afterthought, rather than a premeditated plan. She roused herself out of a coma to lead you to that suitcase, even if she didn't disclose all its contents, Frank said. When it comes to masterminding a murder, the narcissist psychiatrist is a better fit, Jerry asserted. If Libby was onto him, it would sure help explain why he was intent on killing her. Maybe you're right, Jessica, that he assumed she'd told you about Shannon's murder. That would explain why he decided to get rid of you, too.
Your idea about the shrink being more suited to murder makes sense, I guess, Jessica said.
About as much sense as murder ever makes, Frank said, shaking his head in bewilderment. Once you've crossed that line and killed, there's a sordid logic for killing again to cover it up by going after you and Libby. Don't forget about Carr's associate, the Red Devil, behind the effort to kill Libby before she could come out of her coma. He's got my vote as Shannon's killer, with or without Carr's help. Despite her disorganized thinking and bizarre behavior, Libby must know something. It can't just be about Carr's dirty work because he's dead. So why kill Libby? Laura asked. The group fell silent as several servers swept down on them with appetizers and refills of their drinks.
I can't answer that, Laura, but you must be on the right track. I guess that brings us to Team Two.
What's your story? Jessica asked. Now that food had appeared, she was glad to end the discussion about the suitcase and its contents. I've already given Frank a quick heads up so he could call it into Hernandez. The good news is that we already have the doctor's Mercedes in impound. My guy hauled it from the tramway parking lot the day he died. Hernandez is laying the groundwork to have the forensics team go over it.
Whoa. Maybe they'll find Shannon's blood in his car. Do you think that's where Libby found the rosary?
Ryan asked, cramming fries into his mouth.
That's an excellent question.
Libby left her car in Manhattan Beach when she and Shannon went to the desert. The rosary could have been in it before that Thanksgiving weekend when Shannon disappeared. Maybe she took it from the shrink's car with all the other items. But then why not stash it in the suitcase with everything else? Frank asked.
It's Libby, so who knows? Jessica responded. She could have picked it up any time or somewhere else other than Carr's Mercedes. Stashing all that stuff she found in Carr's Mercedes does mean she went back to her condo after her Thanksgiving weekend at the La Quinta Resort. How did she get back to Manhattan Beach? If she's been back at her condo, why didn't she take her own car with her when she returned to the desert for our rendezvous at the top of Mount San Jacinto?
A rental could answer both questions. Dad's guys can find that out when they put a timeline together for what Libby's been doing since Shannon disappeared. If she thought she was being followed, she might have felt safer driving a rental. Let's hope the lab learned something helpful about that rosary, Frank said.
Too bad we can't get a report from whoever has had Libby under surveillance, huh? I'll make sure the guys investigating the trouble at Mount San Jacinto link up with Hernandez's investigation into Donnelly's disappearance. There's not much time between the two incidents, so it makes sense to coordinate their investigations. I didn't think to ask, but if Libby used a rental car to get to that meeting at the top of the tram, she must have left it in the lot. That could be an impound, too, unless someone at the tramway didn't make the connection to Libby and had the rental agency retrieve it.
Uncle Don stopped talking and typed what must have been a reminder on his cell phone.
That's a great idea, Jessica said.
Okay, so back to your search of Carr's house and office. What did you find?
The members of Team Two all looked at each other.
You'll love this,
Don said, downing a little Peking duck spring roll after dipping it in plum sauce.
There wasn't much left to find. Someone got there before us.
No way!
Brian gasped.
Does it look as though a tornado hit it, like Laura's house did after Bedrosian's guys finished with it? Jessica asked.
No. If anything, it's likely to be cleaner and more orderly than it was the last time Carr was there. Except a lot of his stuff is missing,
Uncle Don replied.
What does that mean? Missing as in a burglary? Jessica asked.
In all my years as an investigator, I've never seen anything like it, Jerry said, with what might have been a note of awe in his voice. There's no food in the fridge or the cupboards, no garbage, no mail,
bills, files, drawers in his house and office emptied of their contents. Glassware, silverware, dishes, all gone. His clothes closet cleaned out. The linen closet and cupboards, too. Even the bed is stripped down to the mattress. This looks more like a crime scene cleanup crew went through there rather than a crime scene. Except that instead of taking out the stuff trashed by intruders, they just took everything. Jerry stopped talking, and Don picked up the story. They left the furniture, but had moved it around to clean the area beneath the furniture. We found the office in the same condition. Desks in the reception area and Carr's office are empty. The file cabinets, too. All the bookshelves cleared out and wiped clean. The cushions on the couches and chairs, like at Carr's house, must have been vacuumed. There's not a crumb, a coin, or a stray hair under those cushions. Don took a sip, shaking his head. Furniture is still there, but the electronics in the office and home are gone. No computer, phone, DVR, tape recorders, or answering machines. Carr's big flat-screen television is still in his house, and his stereo equipment, but no communication devices of any kind. It's as though Carr had packed up all his personal possessions to move out and cleaned it, top to bottom. There's a faint odor of cleaning products, Don added. Even the drains were cleaned and closed up to contain the smell of strong disinfectants used in them. I wish they'd left a business card. It sounds like they do a better job than the crew I use in Rancho Mirage, Bernadette said, her eyes glittering with interest. So, what was the big idea? The big idea was to sanitize the place, Peter said. That's a fixer job, not the stuff we do at our shop. Not that we haven't been asked to do it a time or two. Both Frank and Don were scrutinizing the man. Hey, I said we don't do that kind of work. It could have been a crime scene cleanup crew, but I'm guessing this was the work of a more private enterprise. Okay, so are you saying Carr killed Shannon at his condo or his office and someone sent in a cleanup crew? Frank asked. It could be. I'm assuming someone has attempted to remove any evidence Carr, wittingly or unwittingly, left behind that could link him to Shannon or any of the women who were victims of his scheming. Small, movable items that might have stray fingerprints on them are gone. Same with his clothes, and anything else that might have had traces from Shannon Donnelly or Libby Vanderwert, supposing the hookups with both women took place at his house, Peter replied. Well, at least some of those trysts did occur at the doctor's house and office, if Libby's archive of precious moments is to be believed. So what? Isn't that overdoing it to go to so much trouble to cover for a dead guy? Even if Shannon Donnelly is dead and Carr's responsible, why not let the cops get all the evidence they need to peg him for it? Jessica asked. Let's not forget you have his car. The police must have had clothes and other items he had with him at the hotel. Any laptop, cell phone, or tablet with him is likely to have more personal communications on it than anything in his office, Laura added. Your point about his car is a good one. If he killed Shannon at his condo or office, the body wasn't there. That must mean he used his car to get rid of it. Even though Libby seems to have played CSI going through his car and collecting what she regarded as evidence of some kind, I doubt she could have done as good a job as those fixers. Without being able to sanitize his car, why bother?
Well, this all goes back to the notion about conspiracy. I bet money that Carr's silent partner is trying to make it hard to find a connection that leads back to him, even if Carr does get nailed for Shannon's murder. There's no Rolodex, no record of referrals, or client records, like you wanted us to look for. There must have been other clients mixed up in the scam he was working with Libby and Shannon. Otherwise, why take all the files, rather than just Libby and Shannon's? The cleanup made sure whatever information Carr had squirreled away in his file cabinets, or on the hard drive of his office computer, went away before the police could subpoena his files and go through them. He had wall safes in both places, and those were opened and emptied too, Don said.
Wow. Maybe Carr had his private stash of incriminating evidence, like Libby, something that would compromise his partner in crime. I suppose if that partner of his had ever met with Carr at his home or office, the super cleaning would make sure that there were no stray prints or trace linking that red devil to Carr, Jessica added.
I said conspiracy, but nothing about a red devil, Don retorted.
Don't be silly. Jessica knows it's not a red devil. A devil wouldn't leave fingerprints, Bernadette said.
Wouldn't someone have seen something like that happening? Tommy asked. I've helped a lot of friends move. Packing and hauling all cars' stuff away like that would have required a van or a truck, even though they left most of the furniture behind. It would have taken hours to do that.
The local police are checking into it. If businesses in the area around the office have security cameras, they might have captured an image of a vehicle parked at the curb or in the alleyway behind the doc's office.
I've passed that info along to the guys investigating the incident at the tramway. There are cameras in the hallways outside the doctor's office, so we might get pictures of them entering and exiting Carr's office, Don said.
That's not likely to get you much. These are pros. My guess is you won't get a good look at them or their vehicle. If you do, it won't have much in the way of identifying information anyway. Most likely an unmarked truck or van, stolen license tags.
Frank and Don were eyeing Peter with cop-like suspicion. Again.
Sounds like you're familiar with the M.O.
I'm familiar with such an operation, yes. Peter paused, reflective. Perhaps his roots in Black Ops were calling him back in time.
If they were making sure Carr didn't have secrets hidden away, why not slash the furniture and the mattresses like those guys did at Laura's house? Tommy asked.
They could have had a portable X-ray machine. That can be used to check for items hidden in furniture and other places, so no need to slash and smash everything. It's a much easier way to search for hiding places.
Speaking of hiding places, that's a perfect lead-in to what we found in that otherwise squeaky clean office.
Kim found it, Don announced, after another penetrating look at Peter.
What can I say? I worked for a sleazebag with about a million hiding places, and I like to think I found them all while enslaved by the man. Think of me as that X-ray machine on two legs, Peter.
Kim had made the rounds at Carr's home and office, looking for hidden panels and loose bits of carpet and baseboards in cupboards and drawers, even the closets.
The guys were thorough. You could tell they'd checked the vents and light fixtures, toilet tanks, the attic, hiding places like that. It was frustrating. Nothing taped to the underside of tables, desk, bed, file cabinets, or the backs of movable shelves. I was about to give up, but when I pulled out the desk drawers, I found it. A packet of black and white photos. Not in the drawer, but behind one of them, like it was hidden on purpose or accidentally shoved back and kind of stuck there, like when you have a drawer that's crammed full and stuff sort of spills over and falls down in behind the drawers. Kim let everyone know she'd finished talking by shrugging her shoulders, drooping her eyes, and resuming her lunch.
The originals are bagged, tagged, and stowed in the evidence chest, but I shot copies for us.
Jerry passed his camera to Jessica. She held it with both hands, even though one arm was held to her chest by a sling.
"Can you tell me what I'm looking at?" she asked, staring at the picture of a man in profile. There was something familiar about him. Maybe it was just that his type was a recognizable one. A well-coiffured man in an expensive tailored suit, sporting a high-end watch on the arm outstretched to open the door he was about to enter.
"It's some guy about to go into Dr. Carr's office," Tommy explained. "That corridor could use some updating. Shea 90s, don't you think? For what he's paying, he deserves better."
"Was paying.
Deserved.
Okay, he's dead. I'm done."
"There's more. If you advance to the next picture in the file. That one was taken first, since you can see him head on."
Jessica did as Jerry instructed. The man in the hallway, approaching the door to Dr. Carr's office, looked almost straight into the camera. That odd sense of familiarity was stronger. A third picture showed him from the back, leaving with Carr and a young woman.
"The timestamp on the photo says that third one was taken about 20 minutes later, Jessica."
"He seems so familiar to me. Do you think he's a celebrity?" Jessica asked.
"Let me see. If he's a celebrity, I bet I can tell you who he is."
Bernadette flipped between the photos, peering at them.
"No, I don't think he's a celebrity. He's not anyone I've seen in my magazines or on my shows."
"Bernadette's always up on things like that, Uncle Don," Tommy said.
"Yeah,
If she doesn't recognize him, we can rule out the Hollywood crowd, Laura added with great conviction as she took a turn examining the photos. That's Carr leaving with our mystery man. But who's the woman? Even from the back, you can tell that's an expensive suit. Stylish. Those little asymmetric twisty shoes she's wearing are Prada. Her wardrobe is too office chic, and she's a blonde, so it's not Libby or Shannon, Jessica asserted after taking the camera from Laura and reviewing the photos again. Another woman. Imagine that, Kim muttered, looking at those photos. With guys like Carr, there are always more women. So, what do we make of it? Jessica asked, that sense of recognition nagging at her, like one of those moments when an elusive word is right on the tip of your tongue.
Carr must have had some reason to keep them. It's clear they're from the security camera footage, not just because they're black and white, but because of the angle from which they're shot, and that grainy look. It could be a client about to enter the doctor's office, but 20 minutes is a short session. A little odd for the doctor to be leaving with two clients, but what do I know? Maybe couples therapy. Then why would Carr have gone to the trouble to get the photos in the first place? And why stash them away like that?
Don asked. The high-end clothing is too steep for the visitors to be pharmaceutical reps, but they could be business associates rather than clients. I suppose if their business was the underhanded kind, and these are his co-conspirators, we could be back to the idea of some plan on Carr's part to blackmail them. Jessica flipped through those photos again before she handed the camera back to Jerry.
Could be, but by themselves, I can't imagine how those photos could have been of much use to him. They're completely useless to us at this point. We can speculate all we want, but that's not evidence of a crime. We'll submit them and get them on the record, though, Frank said.
Hard to believe the crew that went through there missed them. Good work, Kim. Kim popped her head up and looked at Jessica as a smile flitted across her face. Can you send me a copy, Jerry? I can't help thinking I've seen the guy somewhere before. Maybe if I stare at the photos long enough, I'll remember.
No problem. I'll do it right now.
Seconds later, a pinging signaled their arrival on her cell phone. Don, it's been almost a week since Carr took that fall off the mountain. Did the police get a look at his home and office before they got cleaned out?
Yes. They went through both places in a cursory way. They did a quick sweep looking for a suicide note, just in case that's what he was planning. They checked recording machines at his home and office to see if Libby left any messages suggesting they meet, but there was nothing from her. They checked his calendars and appointment books, called his answering service, too. It's not like they had a reason to check things out as they might have done if either place was a crime scene. Preliminary checks at the house and office were part of their efforts to produce a timeline, clarifying Dr. Carr's whereabouts prior to his appearance at the top of the tram.
Okay. So what did you find out from that?
Well, as far as we can tell, Carr was already out in the desert for the weekend before he made the trip up on the tramway. He visits on a regular basis, and even has a favorite suite he books at one of the casino hotels. That's where he was staying the day he was killed. The homicide unit went over that room carefully. I don't know what all got checked into evidence, but I can find out. From interviews with the hotel staff, Carr was a well-known womanizer and often had one with him. Investigators showed pictures of Shannon Donnelly and Libby Vanderwerk to hotel staff. They recognized them both, though nobody could say when they were last seen with Carr.
What about phone calls? Libby acted surprised to see him, but did she invite him to meet her at the top of the tram?
His cell phone records show several calls that day, the last one at about 12:30, but it wasn't Libby,
Don said.
Who called him? Jerry asked. This will add to the conspiracy theory. The number tracked to an unregistered phone. He received several calls from the same number in the previous month,
Don replied.
Cool. A burner phone, Brian said. Someone could have been following her, so she wasn't totally paranoid. I mean, what if that's who called and snitched to Carr about where she was? Very good, Brian. You may have a future in security, Peter commented.
Yes. That would explain how Carr ended up there a little while later. I met Libby around noon, and we started down that trail not long after that. If someone spotted the two of us together, that could have prompted a call to Carr. If someone told Carr that Libby and I were up at the tramway together, it could have set him off, thinking it was a secret meeting. That could have confirmed his suspicions about me, since he was already convinced I had inordinate influence over her. I guess it takes Libby off the hook for premeditated murder if she didn't lure Carr up there.
Maybe, but this whole thing with Libby, Shannon, and Carr still has the markings of a classic love triangle, doesn't it? It might explain why the two women fought that night after a movie and dinner, and why they both called Carr that night. Could be they were fighting over him. Libby's not out of the picture yet when it comes to Shannon's disappearance. If she went off the deep end and eliminated her rival, that would have been a reason for Carr to keep her on a short leash. If he went to the police about Libby, his own extortion racket might have been exposed. He didn't want any of that to get to you, Jessica, so he might have decided the way out was to get rid of both of you up there last week.
I hear you, Frank. This feels like we're on a merry-go-round. All of that implicates Libby and Carr in a twisted way that I can understand, but it doesn't explain why someone wants Libby dead or would go to the trouble to clean up after a dead man. Why not let the police find whatever there is to find and let Carr take the fall for an extortion racket and the death of one of his women friends?
Unless Carr's partner is as paranoid as he and Libby both were. This is such a strange combination of the stupidly impulsive and the maniacally conniving. Maybe Dr. Dick and Libby were both loose cannons, and the missing link is the guy with deep pockets calling the shots, Frank said.
Yes, I agree with you that the person responsible for the stupidly impulsive part of that equation is lying in the ICU, or maybe in the morgue, Jessica said. Carr made it sound like he was the one who decided it was time to toss me and Libby off a cliff, like he was taking out the garbage. That had to be opportunistic, given that Libby's impulse instigated our meeting.
If he was trying to clean up after himself, he sure ended up creating a bigger mess, Peter offered. That's what stupidly impulsive gets you, Don said.
So far, the maniacally conniving efforts haven't been much better. The thug sent after Libby screwed up too, and a sniper had to clean that mess up. But then he got caught on film doing it. The sanitizing strategy will slow the police investigation down, but it won't end it. In fact, the cleanup efforts scream conspiracy, don't they? More mess. Jessica shook her head.
Yeah, just like the Cat in the Hat, Brian observed.
There was a moment of puzzled silence as all turned to him.
You know how the cat sends Thing One out to clean up and ends up making a bigger mess, so he sends out Thing Two, and cleaning up makes that mess bigger, too? Okay, great. Forget Libby's Red Devil idea. What we're looking for is the Cat in the Hat, Frank noted with sarcasm. Actually, Brian makes a good point. I'm sure the guy who's ordering hits and sanitizing things thinks he's smart. Maybe he is. We don't know how far he's gotten with whatever scheme he had going with Carr. Still, anybody who sees whacking somebody as a cleanup strategy has got to be out there, if you know what I mean. I'm guessing he's improvising under pressure, too. Whoever made those calls to the pros put them in a tough spot, demanding quick intervention without advance notice or time to plan. That's what led to mistakes at the ICU and at Carr's office, Peter offered. Bad guys are never as smart as they think they are. Right, Frank? Don asked. That's true, Dad. I suppose Peter's right, though. Maniacally conniving is just another version of desperate. Carr's co-conspirator is throwing up roadblocks that will stall the investigation, but as Jessica points out, won't end it. There are more jurisdictions on the job now than ever. I'm guessing the guy is desperate to buy time if what you're saying is true. Buying time the way he's doing it costs a bundle, too. With those deep pockets, if he's afraid of getting caught, why not just pack up and leave? Something important is holding him here, Frank replied. Hey, maybe he still hasn't used the ultimate multi-purpose cleanup machine. Could be that's still in his hat, Brian said, with a knowing look on his face.
Where's that food? Bernadette asked.
Brian will stop talking about the Cat in the Hat if he has something to put in his mouth.
Stop chewing up that straw, Brian.
He put down the straw.
Bernadette's utterance, like magic, conjured up a flurry of activity as food appeared. The rest of their lunch was much quieter. Don and Frank excused themselves as soon as they'd finished eating, hitting the road to deliver the evidence collected. After lunch, the rest of them checked into their hotel rooms, the guys hauling in luggage from the loaner car that Peter had provided to Bernadette and Jessica. Peter was accompanying them to Malibu, with Brian riding shotgun